Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's start out with a couple of emails from regular listeners. The first one from Sybil, sending a message from Switzerland. Dear Dr. Dawn, regarding OCT angiography, you probably remember my story of a Staph aureus infection in the eye, followed by 6 weeks of intravenous antibiotics. I was then being treated by the Byers Eye Institute at Stanford by a retina specialist for 6 months. He released me and said everything looks very good and that I should get another checkup in about 6 months. I then moved overseas, and I've made an appointment at the University Hospital in Zurich. The doctor has sent me a letter to sign an agreement for OCT angiography, which they're calling fluorescein-angiography. I love it. I am not too keen to have a dye injected, just like I wasn't happy to have gadolinium injected once. But since I refused for an MRI some years ago, what's your take on this dye? I'm surprised that Stanford never did this. Nothing has changed with my eyes. And this is my first appointment since Stanford last June. So, well, I think what you're running into is protocol-based medicine. They haven't actually even seen you yet. And they're screening you essentially for macular degeneration because that's the most common disease that people at retina centers see. And so I think they're just trying to be efficient and do this study ahead of time so that they can classify you as either having leakage in the blood vessels in the back of your eye, because that's what this will show, or no leakage. This, as I said, is probably a protocol. The question that you'll have to resolve with the clinic is whether this is your ticket to entry and they won't even see you without you having done this, or whether you still have any agency over there in the Swiss system because you don't want to have a dye injected. I do want to emphasize this dye will go into a vein in your arm. It is not going to go into your eyeball. But I know you have a thing about not having chemicals injected. Fluorescein is one of those generally recognized as safe, been around forever things that I don't worry too much about. I have many patients who have macular degeneration, and part of what they have to do is undergo a dye study annually. So it's become very routinized, and they may indeed just do this as kind of, let's get that out of the way, because sooner or later we're going to want to rule out that particular entity. This might be negotiable, and I think that's where I would suggest you start, is talk to the office manager if you can get them maybe on the phone or get an email for them and explain that you are reluctant to do this and would like to see the doctor first to confirm that it's actually necessary. Because based on your history, I don't think it is. But there's something I don't know. Anyway, that's my answer. I hope it helps. I want to parenthetically comment that I always encourage people to ask questions and not to yield up their agency. There's the hospital process, everything from the hospital gown to the process of getting admitted to the hospital is sort of a subtle psychological, let's call it a mind game, to induce a state of passivity. Often you're tied to a bed or a IV pole. Effectively, you're tied to the bed by the IV pole. And you have a needle in your arm. You don't want to move around that much. Movement is really important. And just getting out and walking around the halls, even if you have to bring your new best friend along for the ride, I highly recommend having a family member with you. I highly recommend having a notebook. And when you're told something, write it down in the notebook. It's amazing how that changes the behavior of the people around you. They're busy and they're in a hurry and they want to do the right thing. Let's be clear. This is a systems issue. It is not a people issue. That being said, all we have to deal with when we're in the hospital are the people taking care of us. So if their institution can engage in subtle manipulation, I see no reason that we shouldn't engage in subtle defensive manipulation right back at them. All right, so let's go on to our next email. This is from Jean in Royal Oaks. And Jean writes, "Hi, Dr. Dawn. Your opinion of creatine supplement, please. Thanks." Jean, a woman of few words, let me just respond with a few words, more than a few, in fact. Creatine is having a moment. It's a molecule naturally found in the body. It is made up of three main amino acids, glycine, arginine, and methionine. It is mainly produced in your liver, kidneys, and pancreas. Well, there's a lot of bodybuilders out there, and they are all on the internet. They are all looking for the magic formula. And so there's a lot of stuff about creatine that is not science-based, and there's some stuff that is, primarily around the muscles. It does help with muscle development in someone who's trying to build muscle. It's one of the basic proteins, basic amino acids, that's used in building muscle. So that's all good. There are, however, as there usually are, all sorts of influencers and people who are making money on advertising who want to keep you on their site while they tell you something interesting that may or may not be true, but is juicy and interesting and engaging because, hey, that's how they make their money. So you got to consider the source. There's some data, I would say reasonable data, to say that if you are an older person who's trying not to lose your muscle and you start weightlifting, taking 3 to 5 grams, that's grams, not milligrams, of creatine might help you build muscle a little bit faster. There's not that much data in older people, but that which we have does suggest that it could be good. It doesn't do anything if all you're doing is aerobic exercise and you're not doing weightlifting. You're not going to build muscle, and it's not clear whether it helps maintain muscle mass unless the person changes their activity. There are claims of improvement with cognition and mood, and those are not really supported by much research. First of all, cognition and mood are really, really, really hard to score and test. And so they're very subjective. We use questionnaires. The questionnaires are validated, but there's lots of fuzz factor in these studies. There's some suggestion that maybe it helps prevent bone loss. I think a lot of that might just be due to the people who are taking it are exercising with weights to build muscle. And so that's itself going to help avoid bone loss. So it's hard to tease out the factors. And of course, you can't have a control group here very easily. Last minute things, caveats, as we say at the end of one of these. Do not load. That's one of those internet myths. It'll just cause bloating and GI upset. The idea with starting at 20 grams for a couple of days is kind of a nutso excess thing, which is really very characteristic of many of the weightlifter sites. You know, they're going for the quick fix. Just start at 2 or 3 and build up to 5 if you want to, if you tolerate it, if you don't get GI upset or bloating. Speaking of which, it does cause fluid retention. So I don't recommend this in people who have any history of congestive heart failure because they will retain a fluid and gain a couple of pounds, and that can be confusing. Another medical confusion is that it can raise your creatinine, which is one of the markers that we use in medicine to gauge kidney function. So it can make it look like your kidney function is deteriorating. In fact, it can deteriorate kidney function if you have moderate kidney disease. So if you have like stage 1 or stage 2 kidney disease, you can cautiously use creatine. If you're stage 3, I would stay away from it because your kidney is already showing signs of not being good at filtering out stuff, and you're giving it a big load of stuff to filter and a lot of nitrogen to get rid of, and that's probably going to overload the system. So that is creatine. So moving on to our stories for the day, we're going to do a walk around some deep and somewhat geeky neurology. But first, I want to just put out a little public health warning and remind people It's not too late for your flu shot. We do have a shift in the strain that we're dealing with. It's a member of the
H3N2
family. By the way, the H is a marker on the surface of the flu virus capsid, and the N is neuraminidase, and that's something that is on the, these are both available on the outside as markers, but they also serve a functional purpose in helping the flu virus infect people. And they are what we call very rapidly mutating. So that's why we run into having to get flu shots every year. They're working on a vaccine that could be retooled much faster. Our problem this year was that they have to finalize the flu shots in the spring. And if a strain pops up a little bit later that becomes the dominant strain, which often it does because it's enough different that last year's flu vaccine doesn't work so well for it. Anyway, it would be lovely if we could create vaccines faster. I seem to recall reading a little earlier this year about the research in an mRNA, a messenger RNA flu vaccine, getting defunded because I don't know why, some reason. I guess that, you know, mRNA vaccines are scary. That would have probably saved a lot of lives because you can rapidly just peel out the mRNA and drop in another one. So you can make the vaccine much more quickly, one of the great advantages of this kind of vaccine. Anyway, go get your flu shot. I want to mention there was a wonderful Radiolab sometime in the last few weeks called Brain Balls, and it's all about the history of the discovery of organoids, which I did not know. And it's an amazing story of, like the penicillin and many things in science, a kind of accident, but when things don't go the way they're supposed to, a scientist says, let me take another look. And that other look has transformed medical science. So it's a lovely history to hear about. Organoids are small tissues that are derived from a stem cell. We now can create pluripotent stem cells. And then we can take a differentiated cell, like something that's growing rapidly, like a baby's foreskin in the case of the organoids. But you could take any bit of body skin that's been removed. You can feed it chemicals and change the DNA that's turned on in that cell back to something resembling an embryo. And then you can use that to patch an organ. Or if you suspend it in liquid and feed it just the right chemicals, those cells that you've turned into, let's say, neurological stem cells, will actually differentiate into little tiny functional brains, hence the title Brain Balls. These organoids can be made for kidneys, for hearts, for all sorts of things. And let's just say you're researching a genetic disease where the kidney is lacking a certain protein and you want to understand what drug you could possibly give the person who had this disease. Well, trial and error on drugs is very hard. But what if you make a whole bunch of kidney organoids and then you use tissue from the person who has the genetic disease? So now you've got a whole bunch of little lab animals, if you will, that are just little tiny balls about the size of a small seed, maybe a white bean or something like that. But it's got all of the tissues and it has the primitive structure of a kidney. So it grows the it grows the tube and it grows the glomerulus and it's primitive, but it's got all of the things. And so first of all, it's kind of amazing that the cells know what to do. We used to think we had to teach them what to do with chemicals, but turns out you give them the right environment, they'll just run their programming. Then once you've got your bottle full of organoids, you can separate them out and you can try giving drug A to one and drug B to the next one, and drug 156 times through the alphabet to, you know, double Z 99999 until you finally find something that actually works, that and you've tested it. So now you can move on to animal trials and human studies. So it's great for rapid screening of the, you know, just we've got millions of chemicals that we've invented that are sitting in a database, and it's hard to go through that really quickly, and particularly if you're having to use lab animals. So these organoids have really, really revolutionized medicine. And Stanford researchers last year actually created an assembloid. An assembloid, basically, they took four organoids that were neurological, and they put them in the same bottle, if you will, and spontaneously, without being told what to do, the organoids attached to each other and built interconnections. So it's what they were testing was something called the ascending sensory pathway. So pain, of course, starts in your sensors in your skin or your sensors in that your nerve is attached to. And that nerve, if we're talking about, say, foot pain, let's talk about, for example, peripheral neuropathy, just for an example. Peripheral neuropathy is the longest sensory nerves of the body. And that nerve is about 100 centimeters long. So, you know, 25 inches, something like that, 30 inches. It's a long nerve, and it goes all the way up into the spine, and then it connects with another nerve, and that nerve is like an extension cord. Right now, we've plugged it into the extension cord. That extension cord is going to go up to the base of the brain, and then it's going to plug into the thalamus. And the thalamus is the place where we do two things, one of which is we localize where the pain is coming from more in more detail, and secondly, we decide that this sensation is pain. It's just information from the tip of the finger to the base of the brain. Once it gets to the base of the brain, the thalamus says, oh, that's a pain signal. I feel bad about that. That is unpleasant. And then it sends the information to the sensory cortex, another extension cord, if you will. And in the sensory cortex says, maybe I want to move away from what I think is the source of that pain. And of course, when you do that, maybe you find out you just by moving made the pain worse, and then you've learned something about how to reduce the pain, which is to hold still. And this is a very, very primitive pathway. It's widely shared in animals. But the fact that these researchers were able to build a sort of organoid, assembloid model for pain, and they were able to actually hurt their assembloid and watch the electrical activity travel all the way through the extension cords up into the brain and be registered there, because it's very small. They can see the chemical changes. They saw, and they were able to chemically stimulate elements of the circuit and watch it perceive pain. Now, perceive as in register in a structure which, if it was attached to a full brain, would receive pain. There's, you know, in the case of an organoid, it isn't a little tiny brain that's thinking thoughts. It's very important to understand that this is just a primitive biological machine. And yet, I think we all feel a certain caution about how far are we going to take this in science, and I'll probably be talking more about that in the future. But one in three people in the United States have pain, and chronic pain, and this pain often persists. In acupuncture, we call it wind-up, but you have, you know, the injury is healed. The hip is replaced, the disc is fixed, the pain is still there. And there are lasting changes in that pathway. That some of the acupuncture and the electroacupuncture stuff I do is aimed at turning off or canceling those lasting changes and getting things to revert back to the let's call it the basic plan of transmission. Pain medications, well, we've got opiates, which are habit-forming, and chronic pain, and we've got new drugs coming out, which are interesting. They're a sodium channel blocker, but they're not recommended for chronic pain. They're just for post-op pain to keep people from getting addicted to opioids. So we, you know, then we're going out and giving everybody gabapentin, which is an anti-seizure drug and a sedative, because we don't have a strategy to do anything else. So the organoids turning into assembloids is kind of a thing that you would not have expected, that these cells could guide themselves and hook themselves up in the right sequence. But all of that information is there in the DNA. We just didn't know that the cells themselves were capable of stimulating each other to form a complete circuit. So this is a very, this is an interesting wave, interesting proof of concept, but what are we going to get out of it? Well, there are certain genetic diseases, which we were just talking about, that can be very debilitating, and there's they can be caused by single mutations. So being we obviously now understand that we can study those and we can fix what's happening in, or understand better what's happening in these genetic diseases that affect the way pain runs, we may be able to help people with autism, for example, who are often very hypersensitive to pain. And maybe we can develop drugs that would be generalizable for all sorts of pains that are coming up through the spinal cord, essentially create our own endorphin circuitry that naturally could be patented and sold back to us, but nevertheless, a step forward. Our next story is going to talk about that same structure, the dorsal root ganglia, and neuropathic pain. It's about mitochondria actually being transplanted spontaneously in the body and how that process is how your nerves stay healthy. And if that process breaks down, you can develop peripheral neuropathy. And that's something that people often develop from long-term diabetes or from chemotherapy. So these are common problems, not rare genetic diseases. And we're learning things that are going to help us address these. In the spinal column, in the dorsal root ganglion, there are a type of support cell called the satellite glial cells. They do a lot. They clean things up. They're immune support to the neurons, but they also tank the neurons up with energized mitochondria, much like plugging in your cell phone or maybe like an in-flight refueling in one of those jets. We've known for a very long time that that mitochondrial dysfunction is what's going on in peripheral neuropathy. The mitochondria are exquisitely sensitive to heavy metals, for example, and you can induce peripheral neuropathy by overdosing lab animals with, for example, lead or especially mercury. But lead will do it too. Now, the satellite glial cells encircle the neurons, and they have some regulatory activity. But what was recently shown is that they actually grow these little tunneling nanotubules. They come from myosin, which is one of the muscle proteins, and in this case, myosin 10. And they literally grow in a series, almost like a spiral of smaller beads forming a large spiral. And inside the inside of the spiral is a tube. And they send mitochondria down that tube to the sensory neurons and therefore charge them up. When sensory neurons lack adequate mitochondria, they begin to fire erratically, and that sends signals up the spinal cord that are interpreted as pain. It was thought until very recently that these mitochondria, your cell had its own mitochondria, and that those would divide inside the cell. Mitochondria originally were small bacteria that got into bigger amoebas, probably by being eaten, but then were able to resist being eaten and show that they could create a symbiosis with these large amoeba-like cells. And eventually that became all eukaryotic cells. And those mitochondria are key to the functioning. The tunneling nanotubules are a real discovery that had been reported only in other cell types, but not in the spinal column itself. We have seen this type of mitochondrial transfer from stem cells to endothelial cells. So basically, the cells on the inside of blood vessels, the cells on the inside of the gut. We see the stem cells at the base where these cells come from, being able to supply mitochondria. We see also stem cells in the bone marrow, nourishing T cells during infections, because fighting infection is an incredibly neurologically difficult process. So why is this important? Well, as I said earlier, the neuronal activation and the potential firing critically depend on mitochondrial function, and it's that abnormal activity that drives the pain. Researchers have identified the gene that triggers the formation of these tubules, and this offers a tempting target for therapy. I won't go into all the details of how they proved this, but what they were able to show is that you really need two copies of this gene to be healthy if you're a mammal. And when they knocked it out, which nowadays we research what something does by taking it out of the system and seeing how the system breaks, what they found was that in mice, if you infused healthy mitochondria from another source into the spinal column, that you could cure peripheral neuropathy. So we can essentially grow these satellite ganglion cells from a sample of the person's own tissue. We can then feed them really well so that they are chock full of mitochondria. And then we can simply drop them into the spinal column in a human and cure, or at least temporarily cure, their peripheral neuropathy. Imagine a chronic pain that you just go in for an infusion, who knows, twice a year maybe, and your pain goes away. It starts to come back very gradually. You go in, you get another infusion, and you're no longer using capsaicin cream and gabapentin at night to try to get to sleep. You're off of a lot of drugs with a lot of side effects, and you're being subjected to a periodic inconvenience. Sounds like a good trade-up to me. So we're on the thread of talking about mitochondria. Well, where are you going to get the mitochondria? Turns out, almost simultaneously, researchers at Texas A&M create mini mitochondria factories using what they're calling tiny nanoflowers. Again, a first step in reversing all sorts of degenerative condition, including Alzheimer's disease, muscular dystrophy, fatty liver disease. The mitochondria are really the powerhouse. They play an important role in fighting viruses, synthesizing amino acids, sex hormones, and just about everything else. Constantly replacing ATP is the key to our energy. You can think of them as the fuel line. They create adenosine triphosphate, which has energy stored in a chemical bond, just like when you use an internal combustion engine. What you're doing is creating, using those chemical bonds, you're creating an explosion, releasing all of the energy at once to move a metal piston. And that is creating a force that can be channeled to the wheels through a complex series of gears and other apparatus, but basically it's chemical energy driving that car forward. And our vehicle, the one that we ride around in, including the place where we live called the brain, has about 17 seconds of ATP if we weren't constantly remaking it. We break that last phosphorus off of adenosine triphosphate, and then we put it back on. And that, if that shuts down, well, that's how cyanide works. All right. You're listening to Ask Dr. Don, and we were just getting into how we have figured out how to build mitochondria so we can use those little nanotubules and inject, you know, build those satellite glial cells and infuse them into the spinal cord and fix peripheral neuropathy. I mean, you know, not quite yet, but first you have the blueprint for what you're going to do, and then you have to work out all those pesky little unglamorous details to get you to the therapy. Well, Dr. I'm going to murder this. I'm sorry. I'm going to do my very best. Akhilesh K. Gaharwar of the Biomedical Engineering at Texas A&M is one of the researchers who created these little mitochondria factories. What they did was they added little particles, little particles that are actually flower-shaped, so they're called nanoflowers. I have no idea how they create them, but it's like buckyballs and gold tubules. When you make things really, really small, the properties of the molecules change, and they kind of fall into shapes. It sort of reminds me of the way that minerals will, when they crystallize, the crystals will be, you know, four-sided or six-sided, or they'll have this sort of tendency to form a pattern. And it turns out it's not just minerals. It's most molecules if you get the size right. So anyway, you get these flower-shaped particles, and then they're so small that hundreds of them could fit across the width of a human hair. And you put it into a lab dish full of stem cells. Back to those stem cells again, handy little things. And they just suck up the nanoflowers. They're made of a compound called molybdenum disulfate. And it triggers the process that the cells use normally to make more mitochondria. We already talked in the previous story about how the stem cells are feeding the endothelial cells and they're feeding the T cells. Well, this is a natural thing that stem cells do, is they feed their children. If they put the molybdenum in there, these nanoflowers rev up the process and double the normal amount of mitochondria, which those stem cells can then transfer. This is a big deal because being able to rev up the mitochondrial production and presumably have that happen persistently. So we're really supercharging stem cells so that they are more powerful batteries. And stem cells, by the way, do have a homing ability. So just like I was talking about how those organoids homed in on each other, stem cells of a particular organ do have a tendency to home in on the damaged area of the particular organ, and they try to regenerate the damaged area. The problem that we've had with just putting stem cells into the bloodstream is that stem cells themselves, they have that homing ability, but they don't actually have a good blueprint for what you need. So if you inject stem cells into a knee where there's almost no cartilage left, you'll get cartilage. You will. You'll get lots of it, but it won't be a nice, smooth, even thing. It'll be more like what happens when you get an accidental bacterial culture on the hummus in your refrigerator, you know, scattered bumps wherever, you know, they happen, wherever the spores happen to land. That is not a problem if the purpose of the stem cells that you're inserting is just to feed mitochondria into the other cells. So this could be used to create the juice that would power regenerative medicine in amazing ways. So we're looking forward to see what happens and where that goes. Hello, this is Dr. Dawn. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I need to find out if I can take the flu vaccine, even though I'm allergic to eggs.
Well, and what's the nature of the allergy to eggs?
I'm sorry, I don't know that. I've been allergic to eggs my whole life.
Well, okay. So do you ever get, like, when you're exposed to eggs by accident, like in a baked good or something, do you get hives or have a skin rash or wheezing or something?
I vomited.
Okay.
I vomited.
So it's a GI effect. It's a gastrointestinal effect. You'll probably be fine if you really worry. If the effect is gastrointestinal, we don't really consider that the kind of allergy that's going to get you into trouble with a flu shot. If you want to be super cautious, you can have a little bit of flu shot put into the skin, and if your doctor has flu shot available at their place, they can put a little drop of it in the skin, and you can look and see if you get an allergic reaction. And if you don't, then you're good.
Yeah, I think my doctor lied to me a couple of years ago and gave me the regular vaccination.
Well, probably because we're told not to worry about it, but I would never lie to a patient. I would tell them, we're going to do this, or I'm basically giving you the skin test, because when someone tells me they're allergic to penicillin, let's suppose that the only antibiotic I have is penicillin, and I say, well, it was in childhood, right? So I'm like, okay, let's put a little bit under the skin. The skin is going to tell us if we need to worry. And so if the skin doesn't react, then you're good. You're not going to get a blood reaction. You're not going to drop your blood pressure, all that stuff. And the whole egg allergy thing, it's still in there, but we've been told, for the last decade that if the person had an allergic reaction, like wheezing and sneezing and hives, to a flu shot, they never get the flu shot again. But if they have GI intolerance, it's a different thing, and they are unrelated.
Uh-huh.
There's also,
well, you should know your stuff, lady. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You have a good day. Bye bye.
Okay, you too. Thank you. Bye.
We've got two stories about Parkinson's disease and some new research there. We're going to start off with a story about an optical illusion that may have sent us down a false thread in Parkinson's disease for maybe 20 years. So I'm going to start with the history. The first breakthrough in Parkinson's disease treatment came in the early 1960s when Birkmeyer and Horkovich showed that L-2,3-dioxyphenylalanine, which is otherwise known as L-DOPA, alleviated motor symptoms caused by the dopamine deficiency in the basal ganglia. That is how we think about Parkinson's disease. This area called the substantia nigra starts to die off. There's not enough dopamine. And this approach was later justified by finding that tyrosine hydroxylase, which is the enzyme that converts tyrosine into L-DOPA, was diminished in the Parkinson's disease brain. It was later shown that tyrosine hydroxylase was an iron-dependent enzyme. And when we say mineral-dependent enzyme, we usually mean that in order for the molecular scissors to work, they have to hinge around a charged particle like a metal ion. So metals are frequently cofactors for important enzymatic processes. So they found that giving iron could stimulate tyrosine hydroxylase in human brains, and so they started giving it to Parkinson's disease patients. This is in the late 1980s, and Birkmeyer has a paper, and he shows striking improvements in a study of about 100 Parkinson's disease patients who were given iron supplementation. Some even were able to stop their dopamine drugs. Wow, sounds fantastic. But the study was not conducted in a controlled clinical trial setting. It didn't have a placebo. And while it was suggestive, no further work was done. It got dropped because of MRIs. So MRIs start to come along in the 90s. And of course, one of the first places that they started to look was at the brains of Parkinson's disease patients to see if they, to see what they could see and how it was different from the stuff they were had never seen before, but now they were seeing in quote unquote normal brains. And nowadays, you have to put the air quotes, I think, across the board there. But in the normal brains, you'd see X amount of iron in the basal ganglion. And in the Parkinson's patients, they were seeing an increased amount of iron. So there was an argument based on that MRI study showing that increased iron in the brains of Parkinson's disease patients was somehow causing the Parkinson's. But there's a but. The largest study of that the thought was, well, maybe there's this thing called ferroptosis, the, you know, that says iron can lead to cellular death. Maybe that's what's going on in the brain. We can't really prove it, but this is certainly suggestive. So they thought, well, what if we give a chelator? What if we give something that will grab iron? There's a chelator called DFP that will cross the blood-brain barrier. So they started giving this to patients with Parkinson's disease to take iron out of their brain because it looked like there was too much iron in their brain. And there was a, they got mixed results. The largest study and considered to be the largest number, so probably the best study if it's got good technique, was completed in 2022 and also confirmed later that iron chelation led to worsening in Parkinson's patients who weren't taking L-DOPA. So if they were just a little shaky and you did iron chelation with the idea you were going to help them, you actually ended up hurting them, which makes no sense when you think about iron overload. So iron overload, did they really have it in the brain of Parkinson's patients? No. What they had was a problem in converting iron. So there's two forms of iron. There's ferric iron that has three positive charges, and there's ferrous iron that has two positive charges. Now, the ferrous iron is the one that's useful in biological systems. The ferric iron is the inert form, and it's bound to a compound in the blood called transferrin and moved between tissues, and it's stored. Excess iron is stored in the cells. In fact, we have an iron storage disease called hemochromatosis, which is caused by excess ferric iron atoms. And in the meantime, ferrous iron, the two positive charges, is critical to mitochondrial biogenesis, enzyme catalysis. And here's where the optical illusion comes in. MRI is a magnetic imaging process. So it's more sensitive to ferric iron because ferric iron is more paramagnetic than ferrous iron. So it's more likely to be found in higher concentration. When you look at the brain, it's going to look like there's more iron in the brain of people with Parkinson's disease. And what we see in Parkinson's disease is, in fact, accumulation of ferric iron in the substantia nigra. But that was a mirage because it wasn't the excess iron. This was stored in an inert, non-bioreactive way. It was a non-bioreactive compound. And chelation didn't work. So it turns out that in chronic inflammation, macrophages and other cells sequester iron as the ferric 3+ form, and they do it because bacteria like to eat it. It prevents iron-hungry pathogens from accessing host iron. In fact, anemia of chronic inflammation is one of those things that we see where the bone marrow isn't making enough red blood cells, but we'll find high tissue iron levels in people. It's not the same as anemia of iron deficiency. But what they will find is iron deficiency in of the ferrous, the biological iron, in the red blood cell stem cells. So I know that was complicated. Let me restate it. There's two forms of iron, a good one that we can use and a bad one. if there is inflammation, the body doesn't work right, and it stores the useless one, it accumulates it, but it doesn't really help us. So more about Parkinson's disease in the next story, but giving iron to people with Parkinson's disease is probably a good idea. And I am no longer, if you have Parkinson's disease and you've been told to stay away from iron, you might want to take a look at this article. I will post the reference in the resources section of AskDrDon.com. And, you know, wave this under your neurologist's nose, because iron might actually make you work better and make your brain work better, especially if you aren't already taking L-DOPA. You might see a rather good and rapid effect by a little iron supplementation. Certainly worth a shot. Okay, let's take our next caller. This is Dr. Don. What's your name and where are you calling from?
John, Santa Cruz.
Okay, John, what can we talk about tonight?
I've had, I guess, within about the past year, a significant symptom increase in what I term Parkinson's symptoms. Tremors, I can barely get my garbage can out from the backyard to the front yard on garbage day. I just don't have the energy. And also, I'm losing my proprioceptive sense in as much as when it's dark, I can't do it. I can't walk because of the inability to judge where my legs are.
Mm-hmm.
Does Parkinson type symptoms or disease, does it progress usually very quickly if you... I must be doing something to trigger it more. But,
well, I don't know that, first of all, this is a self-diagnosis. And
yeah.
the thing you're describing about when it's dark, you're having, you know, trouble with your balance.
Uh-huh.
That sounds much more like one of the other topics we've had tonight, which is peripheral neuropathy. And mm-hmm. what happens is people don't feel their toes. And your big yeah. toe in particular is really important for your balance. You're constantly
oh, yeah.
pushing your toes down to keep your balance. And, of course, we've got two balance organs, one in our ear and our eyeballs. And between the two of them, we get by pretty good on two legs, which is kind of miraculous when you think about it. So I would go, the first rock I would look under would be getting a basic neurological examination. Your primary care doctor can do this. And primary care doctors usually have a tuning fork as part of a neurologic exam. And we use it on the forehead to screen for hearing problems, because if the person hears it in the middle of their forehead, more or less centered, they're good. If they hear it way louder on one side, you want to check that ear for hearing loss, which is counterintuitive, but hey, what else is new about the human body, right? Anyway, so the thing about being worse in the dark is not a Parkinson's symptom, but it's definitely a peripheral neuropathy. That could be due okay. to, you know, exposure to lead, exposure to mercury. It could be due to undiagnosed diabetes. It could be due to a B vitamin deficiency. Are you by any chance on proton pump inhibitors like Prilosec or Nexium for reflux or heartburn, anything like that?
Okay, you were talking about the relationship of the two different types of iron.
Yes,
we have at least four different types of blood types. Does the blood type make any? Does blood type have any effect on iron carrying capacity or anything of that nature?
No. It doesn't, oh. not to my knowledge. The iron carry capacity of your blood depends on how much transferrin is in your bloodstream. And it's basically a truck that grabs, that's just like, you know, it grabs up iron and carries it around, because you need iron for your mitochondria everywhere. And, you know, you've got a delivery service, but that truck is expandable. And so in people with a certain disease, they will store too much iron and they'll basically leave dump truck fulls of iron in the kidney, in the primarily in the liver and the lungs. And so it can lead to, actually it can lead to, go to the pancreas too and lead to diabetes. So iron is a very complicated and critical thing. It has to be in the right place at the right time, in the right amount, and too much or too little can both cause disease.
Do you relate a sedentary nature to the amount of mitochondria that one would have? I, quote, retired. I stopped doing things, well, 7 years ago that I used to do all the time. And now I can't do the things that I used to do. And is it true that you decrease mitochondria when you're inactive for a long period of time and increase when you're more physically active?
Absolutely, because the mitochondria respond to demand. So if you're trying to build strength, you want to build it gradually, right? And there's a, like with bodybuilders or with anything, with rehab of any kind, you do a graded program of progressively increasing difficulty, allowing recovery time, a day or two between exercise, and you basically make the muscle burn with acid, because if you don't have enough mitochondria, you're going to revert to burning glucose the old-fashioned way, which produces lactic acid, and that lactic acid is a genetic signal to the stem cells, essentially the muscle stem cells, that hey, we need to make more muscles because we're getting an increased demand. At the same time that you're making more muscles, within the muscles that you've already got, the fibrils are cranking out more mitochondria. The mitochondria themselves are self-reproducing. They borrow, we keep some of their genes in our closet, but they come out to play when the mitochondria ask for them. And okay. So it's a very complex relationship, but it definitely listens to the demand placed on the body and responds accordingly. And if everything goes well, you build back the muscles. It's absolutely important as we age to stay relatively active, and it's easy to become sedentary. And it's a use it or lose it situation. If you're not using something, the body decides that that's not necessary. And I'll just, save myself the trouble of keeping it up. Like, I don't know, a big house where you close up a bunch of rooms because all the kids have gone off to, live their lives, and you don't really need to go into Jimmy's bedroom. And, that's kind of how our bodies shut down if we don't fight valiantly to keep them where they're at. We'll still lose, by the way, but we'll lose a lot slower.
Well, then it's right in my face. I do need to exercise more.
Okay, I'm gonna stop you because we are absolutely out of time. Oh, but if you want to call back next week, I'd be happy to pick this up.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye for now. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long. And stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.